The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Volume 4, The Medieval World, Episode 70, Chinggis Khan, Part 2. In the previous episode, we spoke of Chinggis Khan's life before he was proclaimed Chinggis Khan. He may have been born in the early 1160s. We do know that his name was Temujin. While still an infant, his father was murdered, and alongside his siblings and his mother, Temujin was cast out from the tribe by those who wanted to take power for themselves and deny Temujin what could have been considered as his birthright as the leader of the tribe. While surviving and growing up in relative obscurity, he would learn the skills required to be a strong young man. He would marry the young woman called Borte that his father had organised his betrothal to, and would begin to start his own family. Life was tough, and Temujin was captured by a rival tribe and was lucky to escape. Borte was also captured by a rival tribe, and Temujin and his allies had to rescue her, which they did. When Borte returned, she gave birth to a child called Jochi, which Temujin brought up as his own, even though there was significant doubt about whether Jochi's father was one of Borte's captors. As a young warrior, Temujin's aim was to create a large following through conquest and diplomacy, and this would enable him to survive in a land of clans, alliances and hostilities. He would unite the clans under one rule and one set of rules, so that his subjects and his military would be a disciplined operation. As his power increased, his allies would become his enemies, as they felt that their own position of power over their own clans was coming under threat. Temujin would overcome these enemies and emerge as the one sole supreme ruler, proclaimed as a great Khan called Chinggis Khan, emperor of all the tribes of the steppe. From here, Chinggis Khan's ambitions would grow, and he would set his sights on established nations to the south of the steppe.
Western Xia.
To the south of the lands controlled by Chinggis Khan's Mongols were lands controlled by a dynasty of Tanguts. Although the Tanguts were related to the Chinese, and although they adopted a fair degree of Chinese culture and philosophy, they were distinct from the Chinese. They would also be related to the Tibetans, but they did speak their own Tangut language. They were heavily influenced by Buddhism, but also there was a presence of other Chinese philosophies such as Taoism and Confucianism. These Tanguts occupied a traversable area of land called the Hexi Corridor, which was China's gateway to the affluent societies of the West. So it was a very important location, which saw a lot of trade and wealth passing through. As a nation-state, the Tangut dynasty is referred to as Xixia, literally Western Xia. Western Xia's northern fringes bordered the steppe lands now controlled by Chinggis Khan's Mongols, and the Mongols raided the northern borderlands of Western Xia even before Chinggis Khan's great Kurultai of 1206, where he was proclaimed as the great Khan of the people of the Eastern Steppe. The Tanguts took pride in their individual identity and always looked to keep their distinction from both China and Tibet, taking aspects of both cultures into their own. Western Xia was established during the 11th century, so it was a well-established state over 150 years old. Western Xia was respected by the dynasty which controlled northern China at the time, which was a Jurchen-led dynasty called the Jin. Jin China valued a healthy relationship with Western Xia, not least of all because Western Xia contained the first steps westward on the lucrative Silk Road trade routes. So Western Xia considered Jin China to be their protective allies. With Western Xia occupying the first steps of the Silk Road, Jin China always needed to ensure that Western Xia never became too wealthy or powerful. So the Jin would have been quite indifferent about the Mongols raiding Western Xia territory. The Jin had also been fully aware of Chinggis Khan's ascent to dominance, and this would not necessarily have pleased the Jin, who had made it their business to meddle in tribal politics between the tribes of the steppe before Chinggis Khan's Kurultai of 1206. The Jin had been happy to play the tribes off against one another in a bid to prevent such a great unification of the steppe tribes as Chinggis Khan had achieved. Chinggis Khan was more than happy to raid Tangut territory, with his justification being that they were harbouring fugitives that were enemies of the Mongols, so the Tanguts became guilty by association. The Tanguts were militarily capable, but they did not want to waste military muscle on the Mongols, so they chose to pay tribute to the Mongols to keep them at bay. When it got to the year 1209, the Tanguts opted out of paying tribute, and as you can imagine, this did not please Chinggis Khan. Chinggis Khan set about raising an army, and he would need to raise a considerable army. The nation of Western Xia may not have been comparatively well known or even as large as some of their neighbours, but their military was considerable and quite unlike anything that Chinggis Khan had faced previously. Estimates suggest that the army of Western Xia was double the size of that of the Mongols. The style and nature of each of the armies was not too similar to each other. Both armies boasted lightning-fast bowmen, a strength of the armies of the steppe and their closest southern neighbours. The Western Xia also had the benefit of highly disciplined pikemen who made up the central body of the army and operated in tightly packed phalanxes. The Mongols would have to utilise their greatest strengths in order to avoid falling victim of their inferior numbers. Relaying signals through smoke and flags was a strength of the Mongols, as we discovered in the previous episode. The ability to re-strategize and to very quickly let the entire army on the field of battle know the new strategy was a major strength of the Mongols that could really make the difference on the battlefield. Both sides deployed their cavalry bowmen against each other, and it is possible that the weaponry of the Mongols had a greater range than their opponents, which allowed them to gain an advantage. By overcoming the Western Xia cavalry, the Mongol cavalry had access to attack the helpless pikemen phalanxes, and when this happened, the Tangut's were being depleted at an unsustainable rate. The remaining Tangut's retreated, and this opened up the countryside and a potential route to the Western Xia capital city of Xinqing. The story of the build-up to the attack was featured in our first episode on the Mongols, so we won't go into too much depth about that here. In order to reach the capital city, the Mongols would need to cross a mountain pass guarded by a Tangut fortress. Using a feigned retreat, the Tangut army emerged from the fortress, allowing the Mongols to attack them in the open. This is how the fortress fell and the path to Xinqing was opened. Undoubtedly, Chinggis Khan's disciplinarianism would have been a major factor in maintaining the patience of his army throughout this arduous period, as the whole process of besieging and unlocking the secret of how to take the fortress took a number of weeks to achieve. The same can also be said of the siege of Xinqing. This siege demonstrated that Chinggis Khan was ingenious but also fallible. When he demanded that the besieged citizens provide him with a tribute of 1,000 cats and 10,000 swallows, the confused residents were not to know that Chinggis Khan would send the animals back into the city with flaming pieces of wool attached to them, causing absolute chaos. However, in another episode during the siege, Chinggis Khan made the decision to dam the city's canal. But instead of the desired effect of flooding the city, he actually flooded the Mongol camp instead. Despite this setback, the Western Xia Emperor Li and Chuan eventually conceded defeat and offered his daughter to Chinggis Khan as a wife. Chinggis Khan accepted, and Western Xia was now his vassal state.
Jin China.
Jin China did nothing to help Western Xia to break the siege of Xinqing, despite the Tangut's calling for help from their supposed allies and protectors, the Jurchens. The Jurchens had seen that the Mongols had subjugated the Tangut's, and they may not have expected that to happen, but at the same time, they did nothing to help prevent it. So the Jurchens of Jin China sent envoys to Chinggis Khan to demand his submission, which would help to protect their trade interests. But reports state that Chinggis Khan spat on the ground and refused. His motivations for doing this are somewhat cloudy. It is quite considerable when we look at Chinggis Khan's seemingly relentless desire to invade and conquer everybody. It could have been that he was a completely power-hungry individual and thought that he could rule the world with his style of conquer and integrate. Another train of thought was that he believed that it was his divine calling. Mongols observed Tengrism, which is the worship of a universal power called Tengri, and some believe that Chinggis Khan was guided by Tengri to become the ruler of the world. This might appear to go against the Mongol Empire's aspect of religious tolerance. Chinggis Khan certainly did not try to change the religion of the people that he conquered. The justification for Tengrism being a driver for Chinggis Khan's ambitions is that he regarded Tengri as above all religions that he encountered, and that the religions of the world were a product of Tengri showing itself to different people and nations in different manners. And so for that reason, Chinggis Khan had no need to interfere in the religious practices of his subjects. Whatever his beliefs or motivations, the imperiousness of Jin China when they demanded Chinggis Khan's submission was something that Chinggis Khan had no regard for. For Chinggis Khan, Jin China was just another enemy. Western Xia submitted to Chinggis Khan in the year 1210. And it didn't take long for Chinggis Khan to commission raids into the northern territories of Jin China. As these raids were taking place, Chinggis Khan would be planning to build a huge army that would cross the Great Wall of China and invade the vast realm of Jin China, an enemy whose scale was like nothing he had encountered before. Many tens of thousands of soldiers and horses would have been gathered for the main invasion force itself. What Chinggis Khan had done was to keep the Jurchens guessing exactly how much power he had. When Chinggis Khan sent 30,000 troops to invade and cross the Great Wall, the Jurchens felt confident about defending the wall. But it appears that this invasion was merely a diversion so that a larger Mongol army could breach the border much further west. This meant that the Mongols were now in Jin China territory and a large battle would take place. Once again, the tactical genius that is Chinggis Khan was able to outmaneuver the larger Jurchen army and defeat it using speed and the element of surprise. As soon as the Mongol archers were able to attack the Jurchen phalanxes directly, the result of the battle would become apparent. The Mongols were merciless in their treatment of the fleeing Jurchens, and when the battle was over, the Mongols were merciless in their treatment of the people of the countryside. Village after village was destroyed and plundered. The people of the villages were kidnapped, if useful, and raped and murdered, if not. Men of the countryside were gathered en masse and slaughtered in an iconic act of terror designed to strike fear into the Jin Chinese state itself. The eventual assault on the chief cities of Jin China had been delayed as during the invasion, Chinggis Khan himself was struck by an arrow and needed to retreat and recover. This was certainly not the first time that Chinggis Khan had been injured in this fashion. Around 10 years earlier, during the battles to unite the tribes of the steppe, Chinggis Khan had been struck by an arrow fired by a man called Zugadai, and after Zugadai's confession, Chinggis Khan decided not only to spare his life, but to welcome him into his own army and give him a degree of military leadership. His name was changed to Dev, and he was more commonly known through Chinese language as Zhebei, and he played a vital role in leading parts of the Mongol army during their invasion of Jin China. So once again, this gives us a valuable insight into the way that Chinggis Khan viewed valuable commodities such as capable military enemies, and that he viewed them as something that needed to be integrated rather than destroyed. While the Jin tried to reassert themselves on their northern territories, the Mongols would soon be back after the recovery of their great leader. They would reapply the pressure on the Jurchens, and we followed this story in our episode about the Battle of Zhongdu, which was the capital city of Jin China and the city that we know as today's capital of China, Beijing. The Jurchens began to panic. One of their rulers was assassinated and the cohesiveness of their nation was suffering. The Jurchens were playing right into the hands of Chinggis Khan, who besieged the city with a minority of forces and sent the rest of his men pillaging the countryside. The Jurchens paid Chinggis Khan a huge amount in order to lift the siege, and the siege was lifted until the Jurchens quickly moved their capital to Kaifeng. With Chinggis Khan believing that he had subjugated the Jurchens, he was furious to discover that they were trying to wriggle away from his grasp. So Chinggis Khan returned to Zhongdu in 1215 and destroyed it. The people of Zhongdu suffered the worst fate once again: rape, pillage and murder. Although it has been stated that the Mongols waited for Chinggis Khan to leave the scene first before conducting these atrocities. The Jurchens headed south to their rivals in southern China, the Song dynasty. The Song had no sympathy for the Jin, who were the ones who pushed the Song out of northern China in the first place. The Jin warned the Song that if Jin China fell to the Mongols, Song China would be the next target. Jin China had to survive without the help of the Song, but their ultimate destruction was delayed as Chinggis Khan had other problems to take care of. In the same year that the Mongols destroyed Zhongdu in 1215, Chinggis Khan's fourth son, Tolui, produced a grandson for Chinggis Khan, and he would come to be known as the future Mongol Khan, Kublai Khan. And it would be Kublai Khan, some 64 years later, who would be responsible for the fall of Song China.
Kara Kitai.
The state of Kara Kitai was established by the Khitans when they were displaced from the lands to the north of China by the Jurchens in the first half of the 12th century. Where the Chinese dynasties were found to the south of the Mongols' homeland, Kara Kitai was to the west and in the direction of the Western world. As a young man, while Chinggis Khan was attempting to unite the various tribal confederations of the steppe, a young man called Kukluk, who was the son of the defeated and executed Naiman ruler Tayang Khan, fled westward to Kara Kitai to avoid the wrath of Chinggis Khan. Kukluk was welcomed into Kara Kitai by the emperor Yelu Jilugu, who secured Kukluk's loyalty as the Khan of the Naimans by allowing him to marry his daughter. This peaceful union would not last long. Kukluk's ambitions were much higher than his position, so he would dramatically turn against Emperor Yelu Jilugu by forming an alliance with Kara Kitai's enemy to the west, the Khwarazmian Empire, centred on the lands of Persia. The outcome of the rivalry would result in Kukluk capturing his father-in-law and usurping his throne in the year 1211. After Kukluk's success, the relationship between Kara Kitai and the Khwarazmians cooled considerably. The expansionist ambitions of Kukluk became a concern for Chinggis Khan, and he would choose to turn his attention in Kukluk's direction rather than crush Jin China into oblivion. Chinggis Khan had enough resources to leave military generals in Jin China while he turned his attention westward towards Kukluk. Chinggis Khan would entrust the military general Jubei to front the assault on Kara Kitai and Kukluk. Just with Western Xia, the lands of Kara Kitai were an essential part of the land-based Silk Road routes between East and West, and if Jubei could demonstrate to the population of Kara Kitai that Kukluk was simply a foreign usurper in their lands, then he could gain some leverage over the nation. How much influence Chinggis Khan had over the decisions that Jubei was making is uncertain. We do know that he was making approaches to the Khwarazmian Shah, Muhammad II, in order to deter him from offering support to Kukluk. The culmination of this particular chapter is that Jubei had managed to traverse the rugged mountain landscape, defeat Kukluk's forces in battle, convince the population to reject Kukluk, and finally pursue Kukluk until he was captured and beheaded. The result of which was that Kara Kitai was brought into the realm of Chinggis Khan, and now the Mongols ruled over a vast region of Central Asia with a border with the Khwarazmian Empire, which was centred on Persia. So now this was a direct link between East and West, as from the Chinese context, the Persian societies represented a direct connection to all of the kingdoms and empires of the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe.
The Khwarazmian Empire.
The Khwarazmian Shah Muhammad II was an unpopular ruler. The Khwarazmian Empire was predominantly Iranian, and Muhammad himself was of Turkish stock. Mongolic scriptures are all too keen to highlight his shortcomings, but that would somewhat suit the Mongolic agenda, so we have to take this with a pinch of salt. Khwarazm was fundamentally Muslim, and the centre of the Muslim world at the time was Baghdad. And although the Abbasid Caliphate by this time was reduced to being a ceremonial entity, Muhammad II still understood the value of being officially recognised as the approved Islamic Shah of his nation by the Caliph. When the Caliph rejected him, Muhammad raised an army to march on Baghdad to depose the Caliph. But the journey was unsuccessful due to extreme weather conditions, and many Khwarazmian soldiers lost their lives. This was a disaster for Muhammad, who would have been concerned that this would be construed as a divine message from God that he was not the chosen one. Chinggis Khan had made attempts to approach Muhammad II since their involvement in the affairs of Kara Kitai. It would make sense for Chinggis Khan to get Muhammad on side and open up the wealth of an increased trade relationship for the benefit of both parties. So Chinggis Khan sent a caravan to the town of Otrar on the river known as the Sir Daria, a river that had been touched by Alexander the Great in his expansions around a millennium and a half later, and had been called the Axartes in the Greek-speaking world. The town of Otrar is believed to have been an important trading town of the Silk Road on the Khwarazm border with Kara Kitai, and in the south of the modern country of Kazakhstan. The caravan is reported to have contained 500 camels laden with gold, silver, and prized sable skins and furs, and those of beavers too. The local governor of this region of Khwarazm was Muhammad's uncle Inalchuk. Inalchuk ordered that those who arrived with the caravan be put to death and the goods seized. Chinggis Khan had to weigh up the situation. Did he react violently to this seemingly irrational and paranoid response to his offers of trade? Or did he attempt to retrieve the situation somehow from spiralling out of control? Chinggis Khan decided to send a small group of three envoys to speak directly with Muhammad. And this time, Muhammad issued the command for the envoys to be killed, or at least one of them. Chinggis Khan learned the hard way that this situation was irretrievable, and that Muhammad did not in any way trust the intentions of Chinggis Khan, probably with good knowledge of Chinggis Khan's great victories and conquests in the east. Chinggis Khan prepared an army of anything between 90,000 and 250,000 to invade Khwarazm. The first polity with no links to Chinese culture, or in other words, outside of the Sinosphere, to be invaded by the Mongols. It is suggested that Muhammad had more than this amount of troops at his disposal, and he decided that rather than fight a pitched battle against the Mongols, he would split up and garrison his troops at the various towns around his lands. It may have been the fact that Muhammad was aware of the difficulties that Chinggis Khan had faced in besieging cities in the past that gave him the confidence to believe that this strategy would work. Chinggis Khan had learned a lot from his experiences and gained a lot of knowledge from the societies that he had encountered. So time would tell if Muhammad's strategy was of any use. Certainly, Muhammad's son, Jalal al-Din Mangbuni, was against it. Chinggis Khan would bring everything to Khwarazm. His four main sons by his first wife, Borte, who were Jochi, Chade, Ugade, and Tulue. He also brought two of his greatest and most successful military commanders, Jubei and Subadai. He brought the Chinese siege engines that he had learned of while he was conquering the cities of China. He brought the Chinese engineers with knowledge of mining and gunpowder and how to operate the siege engines effectively. He would bring trusted members of the Kara Kitai military and diplomats who had knowledge and understanding of Khwarazm. He would bring livestock, which would aid the supply to the large amounts of people who were stretched far from their homelands. So often in the past we hear of failures of invasions due to stretched supply lines, but here it seems that Chinggis Khan had thought of absolutely everything. Chinggis Khan also attempted to outfox his opponent by making a beeline for the modern Uzbekistani city of Bukhara, much deeper into enemy territory than Muhammad had anticipated. There, the Mongols destroyed the garrison and destroyed the city. Chinggis Khan told the population that he had been sent to them by God to punish them for their sins, which is indicative of how Chinggis Khan would use both the power of propaganda and the weakness of his opponent's reputation to coerce the citizens to believing that by joining him, they would be picking the right path. Skilled members of the population would either be drafted into the invasion force directly or sent back to the Mongol heartlands to aid the strength of the Mongol nation back at home. Others were used as slaves to increase the manpower of the invasion force. Khwarazmian troops were attempting to defect to the Mongol army. Shah Muhammad II fled the capital city of Samarkand westwards to call for backup. The two great Mongol generals, Jubei and Subutai, pursued Muhammad as far as the Caspian Sea, where it is said that he died in isolation on an island, maybe from starvation or pleurisy. The Shah's son, Jalal al-Din, capitalised on the situation, claiming that his father was a coward and by proclaiming himself as the new Shah of Khwarazm. Jalal al-Din would try to resist the brutal and bloody onslaught of the Mongols. City after city fell and populations were executed by the thousand, with their severed heads being stacked in pyramids in a grim illustration of the end result of resistance, designed to strike fear into the hearts of the next city and encourage their submission without a fight. Jalal al-Din bravely fought back against the Mongols and even scored an impressive victory at the Battle of Parwan in the year 1221. All this did was prompt Chinggis Khan to become involved directly, so he commanded an army against the forces of Jalal al-Din as they were attempting to travel eastwards across the Indus River. There was no escape for the forces of Jalal al-Din, and they were defeated on the banks of the Indus, unable to cross. But as the story goes, Chinggis Khan spared the life of Jalal al-Din, even though the conquest of Khwarazm had been completed. We don't really know why Chinggis Khan spared his life, although it appears that he was still recognised as the Shah of Khwarazm, but that he didn't have nearly enough power to fight back against his enemies on any kind of significant scale. Chinggis Khan could have pressed on into India, but things were starting to escalate closer to home. The scale of the genocide of the Khwarazmian Empire is often discussed by historians when speculating about how this ranks in terms of the level of human loss of life in particular military campaigns. It is thought that the death count of the Mongol invasion of Khwarezm must have reached seven figures. One of the most resonant statements made about the conquest is that each Mongol soldier was instructed to slaughter 24 individuals, and they would be required to collect the ears of the victims to demonstrate their completion of the task. If 50,000 soldiers were commanded to do this, then the number of victims would have totaled over 1 million. It is unimaginable for the average person to understand the emotion of such genocide, both on such a large scale and on an individual one-to-one level. And let's be thankful that most of us will never experience such a thing happening firsthand.
Back to Mongolia.
Chinggis Khan returned to Mongolia in 1223. His generals had used their expertise to invade the kingdom of Georgia and the lands of the principalities of the Kievan Rus, a once mighty and powerful polity that had fragmented and weakened before the arrival of the Mongols. But Chinggis Khan recognised a problem back in the Sinosphere that needed addressing. Western Xia, the realm of the Khitans that had been subjugated by Chinggis Khan around a dozen years previous, had refused to help Chinggis Khan in his campaigns in Khwarezm and was showing an urge to stand alongside Jin China against the Mongols. This was a very dangerous problem for Chinggis Khan and an inevitable hazard of creating and sustaining a vast empire, something that very few had managed to achieve in history. Chinggis Khan created a force to invade Western Xia once again. This time the Mongol army that maybe numbered up to 200,000 were much more experienced as an international army unit, having experienced the different warfare tactics and weaponry of different cultures and integrating them into their own arsenal. The Western Xia army was reluctant to venture too far from its own capital city, Xinqing. But in the same token, it appears that Chinggis Khan was quite happy to avoid a pitched battle and use the Mongols' favoured tactic of picking off settlements one by one, integrating the manpower and helping themselves to the supplies. Another successful strategy that Chinggis Khan employed during his various invasions of territories was to split his army up into two or three separate forces to be deployed in various different directions. And he would do the same in Western Xia countryside too. Chinggis Khan's tactics were so efficient and successful that the hesitant Western Xia's cause was looking grim. Another interesting story within this invasion was the story of a young Tangut man called Chagan, who had become one of Chinggis Khan's most trusted commanders. He was captured and indoctrinated by Chinggis Khan some 20 years previous during the Mongols' initial raids on Western Xia territory. Now Chagan was back and on the opposite side to his own people, who were fearfully under siege in their city of Suzhou. When the Mongols were able to break into the city, Chagan convinced Chinggis Khan to take mercy on the population, and it seems that Chinggis Khan listened to Chagan and did spare the population, only choosing to kill a few rebels. The Mongols continued their gradual conquest of Western Xia, and it took until Chinggis Khan besieged the city of Lingzhou, which was just around 20 miles from the capital of Xinjing, before the Tanguts decided that they had no choice but to react. It is suggested that the Tangut army was over 300,000 strong, and there's every chance that this could have been embellished to glorify the Mongol achievement. The waterways were frozen, which worked in the favour of the Mongol army, who were able to attack the Tanguts with relative ease as a consequence. Little in the way of detail exists about this Battle of Yellow River in November of 1226, but the defeat of the Tanguts spelt the beginning of their inevitable end. Chinggis Khan left his forces to besiege the capital city of Xinqing throughout the early months of 1227, while he himself plotted to invade Jin China, who was suitably unsettled by the turn of events in Western Xia. The Western Xia pleaded with the Mongol army to allow them time to gather the tribute required to organise their peaceful surrender. Chinggis Khan accepted this offer, but made it clear to his men that there was to be no mercy. Once the tribute had been raised and paid, the emperor was to be executed and the city was to be crushed. So this time came to pass. The Western Xia emperor surrendered in September 1227 and he was executed and the city was plundered. However, Chinggis Khan did not get the opportunity to be at Xinqing to celebrate the conquest. The reason? He was already dead. His death was a secret while the conquest of Xinqing was still going on, as the Mongols did not want to give any party any cause for hope. The cause of Chinggis Khan's death is unknown, but one story does exist about him falling from his horse while in combat. Other contradictory accounts of his death have emerged over the years, so the truth about his death...
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening to me talk, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/MBO. Terms and conditions apply.
Remains and will likely forever remain unknown. He may have been around 65 years old. Thank you very much for listening to this week's episode of the History of the World podcast, the second of a two-parter about the life of Chinggis Khan. Now, I'd really be interested to hear from you on this one, so please drop me a line. Email me at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com and let me know what you think of Chinggis Khan. Was he a bloodthirsty murderer, or was he no worse than any other military leader from medieval times or ancient times? I'm really interested to see what you think of him as a person. We say how wonderful he is, but how can anyone be wonderful when they cause the death of so many? But was it just necessary for him to do such things in order to create this incredible empire? So please do write me an email, drop me a line, and let me know exactly how you feel about Chinggis Khan as a character. Now then, if you enjoy the podcast and you'd like to support the podcast, then please visit our website, click on the Patreon link, and consider signing up to make a monthly contribution. You will become a lifelong member of the History of the World podcast, Illuminati, and qualify for gifts and rewards. This week, we welcome into the History of the World podcast, Illuminati, Kevin Roth. So thank you very much, Kevin, and welcome in. As mentioned, if you want to get in touch with the podcast about anything, please drop me a line at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. You can also follow the podcast on many social media platforms, Facebook, X, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Tumblr, Threads, and Mastodon. Just because the episode has ended doesn't mean that it all stops. And if you can't get enough of the podcast, then do also look out for the special debrief episode that will be coming out very simultaneously, maybe about an hour after this one pops up. So do look out for that if you want some extra time of listening to things to do with the History of the World podcast, and particularly this episode. I'll be talking more about this episode, and there'll be a few extra bits and pieces besides. I did a lot of work, actually, in the last couple of weeks relating to the future of the podcast. So I'll tell you a bit more about that in the debrief episode.
Listener messages and reviews.
Just one message, because we only just had an episode a couple of days ago, so we're almost sort of caught up, aren't we? But just one brief but very important message from one of our patrons, Jack Mardlin, who sent a message saying, please let me know my total contribution to date. Am I close to reaching a gift level? Now, just for anyone who is a History of the World podcast Illuminati member who contributes towards the podcast through Patreon, I just want to let you know that this week in particular, I'm going to be putting some work into the sort of Patreon rewards. So if you believe that you may have qualified for a reward, it's very likely that you're going to get an email from me personally in the coming days, in the next few days. And also there'll be another batch of distribution. So I did distribute some gifts in January. I'm going to be doing another distribution in the next week or two. So some of you will be receiving gifts that you're entitled to, and that will be in the next maybe 4 weeks, I would imagine, depending on where you are in the world. So so that's for you all to look forward to. If you believe that you have qualified, and if you haven't qualified, it's probably because you're not a patron. And you haven't signed up yet. So what are you waiting for? Sign up and help to support this podcast. It will give this podcast a healthy future. That's all I can say. Anyway, regardless of any of that, if you still want to listen to this podcast free of charge, you can. That's the beauty of podcasting. If you just want to listen without paying anything, you can. All I would ever ask of you is just to put a good positive review on the forum which you listen to the podcast on. Anyway, that's it for this week. In our next main episode, episode 71, we're going to be tracking the remainder of the story of the Mongols. So we're going to be looking at what happened after Genghis Khan's lifetime, and the important sort of journey through the remainder of the 13th and what happened ultimately, what happened to this vast Mongol Empire ultimately, and, you know, why we don't see it today, you know, where did it go? And we'll be looking at some of the characters, some of the interesting characters along the way in that journey. So that's the next one to look forward to before we just go back and finish off the China story. Before moving on to other parts of the world. So that will be next time. But until then, don't forget to go and listen to the debrief episode that's coming out alongside this episode. So it should be available now. But until we speak again, don't forget, be good.
The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Please consider making a financial contribution by going to the historyoftheworldpodcast.com website and clicking on the Patreon link. Email the show at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. And don't forget to join our social media at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. See you next time.